judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Staff Sergeant Jennifer Y. Galvin, miscellaneous docket number 2026-01. In today's oral argument, we consider the following two issues. One, whether the military judge erred by dismissing the Article 92 Uniform Code of Military Justice 10 U.S.C. Section 892, dereliction of duty offense in specification one of the charge based on the preemption doctrine and the president's limit on novel general disorder offenses under Article 134 UCMJ 10 U.S.C. Section 934. Issue two, whether a special trial counsel had exclusive authority to determine if the reported offense is a covered offense such that the deferral to the commander or convening authority precluded the commander or convening authority from referring charges and specifications for a covered offense. Major Beazle, are you prepared to proceed with oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Hockenberry, are you prepared to proceed with oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Major Beazle, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I request to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
5 minutes it is. Major Beazle, you may proceed.
Senior Judge Gruen, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Heather Beazold, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States. Your Honors, the plain text of the UCMJ is decisive for both issues in this case. For issue one, the text of Article 134 ties the preemption doctrine only to Article 134. So the trial judge erred as a matter of law when she tried to prevent the government from charging Article 92 of the UCMJ based on the preemption doctrine. For issue two, the text of Article 24 alpha authorizes the convening authority to take any action on an offense after deferral, so long as she is not referring a covered offense, which is statutorily defined as specific articles under the UCMJ. So long as the convening authority is not referring one of those 14 specific articles that constitute a covered offense, her referral is permissible. Unless there are questions from the court regarding issue one, I'd like to start by talking about issue two.
Feel free.
Thank you, Your Honor. As an initial matter, the government's position is that this court should not consider issue two because doing so would be beyond this court's statutory authority to consider issues under Article 62 of the UCMJ and would result in an advisory opinion because this court lacks fact-finding authority.
But do you agree that we're allowed to, that we have jurisdiction to determine jurisdiction? For example, do you believe that the issue that was raised by Appelli regarding the Office of the Special Trial Counsel is essentially a jurisdictional issue? And if the military judge at the trial level did not have authority to make any determinations on specification one, then would it be your position that we do somehow have authority to make determinations on those decisions with respect to specification one?
Yes, Your Honor, because the jurisdiction of the trial court and the jurisdiction of this court are separate matters. When this court this court certainly has the obligation to ensure that it has jurisdiction, but this court's jurisdiction is detailed in Article 62. And so when this court is evaluating whether or not it has jurisdiction, it needs only to look at Article 62 to determine whether or not the government has met the requirements to establish jurisdiction. On the other hand, determining whether or not the trial court has jurisdiction is a separate matter. When this court, whether under Article 62 or Article 66, is tasked with determining whether or not the trial court has jurisdiction, it is not saying that itself does not have jurisdiction. That would be an absurd result, because then if this court was saying that it didn't have jurisdiction merely because the trial court didn't have jurisdiction, this court would have no ability to issue an opinion or any type of mandate, which it certainly does when it finds, typically under Article 66 review, that a lower court lacked jurisdiction for some reason. And so this court, when it is determining whether or not it has jurisdiction, needs only to look at Article 62 of the UCMJ, and it's uncontested that the government has established the requirements for jurisdiction under Article 62 in this case.
Isn't it true, though, that under MW versus United States, which is 83 MJ 361, that this court has an independent obligation to determine whether jurisdiction exists prior to addressing the merits of an interlocutory appeal?
Your Honor, that issue is, the court is required to determine whether or not itself has jurisdiction, not whether or not the lower court had jurisdiction to issue the ruling in the first place. And where the lower court has not even considered the jurisdictional issue, and the record lacks, the military judge made no findings of fact, and this court doesn't have the authority to make findings of fact, which would be necessary for it to determine the jurisdictional issue, it shouldn't issue an opinion on that at this time. Particularly because doing so would be an advisory opinion. This court doesn't have the ability to determine whether or not the special trial counsel determined the reported offense was a covered offense, doesn't have the ability to determine that the special trial counsel deferred, how the special trial counsel deferred, and it can't find that the underlying conduct of the Article 92 offense is the same underlying conduct as any deferral by the special trial counsel, because none of those facts are in the judge's ruling. And so because this court can't make its own factual findings, and it would need to issue an opinion addressing issue two, it's not able to do so at this juncture. The appellee has the ability to raise the jurisdictional issue if this court returns the case to the trial level, and at that point it would be certainly proper for the judge to consider the issue and issue a ruling as far as that is concerned.
So your position, if I put it conversely, is that it would be proper for this court to determine an issue that the lower court did not have authority to determine?
Correct, Your Honor, because this court has no ability to determine that the lower court didn't have the authority. The facts are simply not in the record, and this court is bound by Article 62 to only address the issue that the judge addressed, the order that is before this court at this time.
So if I remember correctly, this court granted two issues to attach documentation. One of those issues was documentation that was submitted by appellant with respect to your briefs for us to consider, because you wanted us to understand that there was coordination with the Office of the Special Trial Counsel after appellee issued their brief raising the issue. So is it your position now that you're asking us or basically asserting that we have no authority to consider the facts that were submitted for these very purposes?
Your Honor, that's correct, because this court doesn't have the ability to review the jurisdictional issue at all. If this court decides to review appellee's jurisdictional issue and finds that it has the ability to find those facts based on the documents submitted by the government, then it certainly should consider those facts. But the government's position is that this court doesn't have the authority to address the jurisdictional issue, either the issue posed by this court or the issue raised by appellee in their brief at all, because it was not a matter considered by the judge in her order that's currently before this court.
So a sister service, I believe it was the Navy in United States versus Cruz, did exactly that. Do you believe, or are you arguing, that their decision to go ahead and determine the jurisdictional issue was inappropriate?
No, Your Honor, because in Cruz, the jurisdictional issue was the issue under Article 62 that was before that court. And so that court had the authority under Article 62 to issue that opinion, because that was the order that was raised under Article 62. So in this case, if this court finds that the trial judge erred as a matter of law on issue one and returns the case to the trial level, appellee has the opportunity to raise the jurisdictional issue, either the one raised in their brief or the one posed by this court at that time. And that in that moment, the judge will consider that issue and issue an opinion. If she rules contrary to the government would have the opportunity to appeal that under Article 62. And if that were to come up again to this court under Article 62, as it did in Cruz, it would be proper for this court to consider that issue at that time.
So you're finding, you're arguing that Cruz is distinguishable from the case at bar?
Yes, Your Honor, Cruz is distinguishable because the issue under Article 62 was the jurisdictional issue. But to the extent that this court decides to consider the jurisdictional anyways, Cruz, it should be persuasive to this court because in Cruz, the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals considered the issue that is identical to the issue posed by this court and found that the convening authority had the proper authority to refer the charge. So long as it didn't refer a covered offense, which statutorily defined as 14 articles under the UCMJ.
Okay, so let's get to the crux or the substance of that argument, which is what makes this offense as charged, the dismissed offense, specification one, a non-covered charge?
Your Honor, it's a non-covered charge because it is a charge of Article 92. Article 92 is not one of the 14 articles listed in Article 1 where covered offense is statutorily defined. And so because the convening authority did not refer a covered offense as Congress has defined it, his referral of an Article 92 offense was proper. And this court need only look to Article 24A and the plain language in that article to reach that conclusion. Article 24A allows the convening authority to take any action under this chapter, and the only limit on that is that the convening authority cannot refer charges and specifications for a covered offense. And because Congress statutorily defined covered offense in Article 1 as one of 14 specific articles under the UCMJ, as long as the convening authority is not referring one of those specific articles, they have the authority to do so under Article 24 alpha.
So I understand the covered offense with respect to sexual harassment refers to the standalone offense under Article 134, but I also view the distinction between the DOTI, which was specifically stated in the Article 92 as a sexual harassment DOTI, which is non-punitive, and the intent of Congress, as it seems to me, going back and looking at the congressional intent and the congressional historical record with respect to how we even got to Article 124, and I'll call it Article 124A as the standalone offense. It looks like it was because it was the specific intent of Congress to take any sexual harassment offense, and if you're going to take it forward as a criminal charge, then necessarily it should be charged under Article 134A. So are you arguing that because they took a sexual harassment offense, something that was reported as sexual harassment, investigated as sexual harassment, substantiated as sexual harassment, moved to the EO and the security forces and investigated further as sexual harassment, and then deemed a covered offense by the Office of the Special Trial Counsel, are you arguing that so long as it's not charged under Article 134, small a, that it's not a sexual harassment offense?
Your Honor, that's correct, because Article 92 is a substantively different offense than sexual harassment under Article 134. The point of an Article 92 offense is addressing the disobedience itself, and the Army Court has found that repeatedly. And so the convening authority absolutely has the authority to address disobedience offenses under Article 92, even if they implicate a different article under the UCMJ, whether that be sexual harassment under Article 134 or any other covered offense under the UCMJ. The convening authority retains that authority under Article 24 alpha, and nothing that Congress has written in the UCMJ prohibits that. Understanding Your Honor's concern regarding congressional intent, this court cannot get to congressional intent unless there's ambiguity in the statute. This court cannot interpret a statute merely to address a policy concern or what may be a drafting oversight by Congress merely because Congress may have intended something different than what they wrote. Our superior court has been adamant on that point, and I can provide supplemental citations after this, but in Taylor, in McPherson, our superior court has repeatedly said that even an unintentional drafting gap is insufficient to warrant judicial correction. So even if the record, the congressional record, showed that Congress intended to limit the convening authority from addressing the underlying conduct, that's frankly not what they did. They gave the convening authority broad authority to take any action as long as they're not referring charges for one of those 14 articles. And so
you brought up policy, which I think is very interesting because I think that that is what the military trial judge was attempting to address, was the fact that it seems that the DOTI is a policy, it's a non-punitive article, and the government was attempting to take a criminal sexual harassment offense, and when it was referred back in the Office of the Special Trial Counsel, deferred it back, they tried to take a criminal offense and couch it, or a non-criminal offense, and couch it under Article 92. But the problem, I think, is the fact that they relied specifically on a non-punitive policy regulation. So how does that square with charging it criminally, lawfully, under Article 92?
Your Honor, because as military members, we have an obligation to adhere to our duties. And where a regulation has created a duty, it's a violation of Article 92. It's a criminal offense for any service member to violate those duties. And where that has occurred, the convening authority has the authority to move forward with prosecuting that in a court-martial. Congress gave the convening authority the ability to address a broad range of conduct, whether it be through punitive articles or whether it be through policy and regulations under Article 92, which is a very broad offense. And so...
But you're... Okay, so I think what I'm hearing is you're saying it's perfectly acceptable to take a non-punitive regulation, a policy regulation, and then... turn it into a criminal offense? Isn't it required that you have a very narrowly tailored violation of a punitive article if you're going to say that the duty was based on that regulatory guidance? Isn't it inherent in criminal law and criminal charging that that must be based on a criminal statute?
Your Honor, it is based on a criminal statute. It's based on Article 92. And Article 92 makes it a criminal violation for service members to fail to adhere to duties which they know exist. And that duty can come from a regulation. And so in this case, where the Secretary of the Air Force established a regulation that created a duty to not engage harassing behavior even before it rises to severe or pervasive, service members had an obligation and could be criminally prosecuted when they fail to abide by that duty.
So if they violate a non-criminal policy, then you could just turn it into a criminal charge, a court-martialable offense?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not turning it into a criminal charge. It always is a criminal charge. Article 92 exists so that the convening authority can prosecute somebody for failing to adhere to their military duties. It's a fundamental tenet of good order and discipline of members of the service to adhere to their duties. And so Congress gave the military the ability to address that through a criminal charge, whether that be at a court-martial or any other means that they deem appropriate.
Is there any problem with notice with respect to your argument?
No, Your Honor. Under Article 92, there's sufficient notice where we've charged each of the elements and we've given the service member appropriate notice of what they have to defend against. This is a published regulation that every service member could have access to. We repeatedly receive briefings on sexual harassment. Every service member is on notice of the conduct they are allowed to engage in and the conduct they're not allowed to engage in as it relates to harassment. And so where the government has properly charged an offense under Article 92 and given the accused ample notice of both what they have to defend and where where that duty arises from, we've satisfied the notice requirements.
So at what point in time, what conduct, let's talk about that, what underlying conduct formed the basis of a criminal offense, given the charging nature of Specification 1, which was dismissed?
Your Honor, engaging in harassing conduct before it rose to the level of severe and harassment, and harassing conduct is defined in the regulation.
It's defined, but it's also set out in four elements of Article 134A for a reason. So do you think that you can just eliminate the required elements that actually show that there was harassing conduct, just eliminate having to prove those by charging a dereliction of duty and that is a properly stated offense?
Yes, Your Honor, it is, because it's a different offense under the UCMJ. And so where the government chooses to move forward under an Article 92 charge, we're not required to satisfy all of the elements of Article 134. Now, if Congress had included language in Article 92 that might have created its own preemption doctrine in the way that it had in Article 134, then this court might be correct in having some concern that the government had eliminated elements. But Congress explicitly gave the convening authority and the military authorities the ability to address a different subset of behavior, even though it overlaps under Article 92. And this court and the lower court did not have the ability to pick and choose which of the articles the government chose to move forward on.
Well, I think that's exactly the constraint here. Okay, so while we're all getting used to the covered offenses and how to work with the covered offenses. And where we go when covered offenses are deferred by the Office of the Special Trial Counsel, it seems that there was something to the fact that if you're going to charge sexual harassment under a DOTI that uses the exact same requirements, that looks at the exact same requirements as the criminal offense captured in Article 134 small a, wouldn't it be necessary to take that offense and charge it under Article 134A?
No, Your Honor, it's not, because where Congress has created two overlapping or even identical offenses, even where one might have less elements than the other, the government is free to choose which one we move forward under. And so Congress has not constrained the government's ability to do so. Congress has not said that we can't charge Article 92 for covered offenses or for any other offense. And so where the government has properly charged an offense that Congress gave us the authority to move forward under, even where there is a different offense under the UCMJ that may also capture the underlying conduct, the government is free, and the Supreme Court has been clear that the government is free to choose which one we move forward under.
Well, I think that you said two very important things there. One is that you're not precluded. The statutory guidance or the government or the Congress, you used a bunch of different terms there, does not require you or does not preclude you from going forward on a covered offense. And I think that the statute specifically says, Article 24A, that when it's deferred, you can go forward on any charge you want but for a covered offense. And the constraint here seems to be that you specifically went forward on a sexual harassment, but you colored it a different color. You took it and said, okay, well, we can't go forward under the standalone offense of Article 134A, so we'll go forward with all the exact same intention of this is a sexual harassment, but we'll just call it an Article 92 and save ourselves the trouble of proving elements and also allow ourselves to potentially get a conviction for what very likely may be a non-criminal offense.
Well, Your Honor, I'm sorry if I was unclear in that. I disagree that we moved forward on a covered offense by moving forward on under Article 92. But I'd like to highlight...
So do you agree you cannot move forward on a covered offense once it's deferred?
Correct, Your Honor. The statute precludes us from doing so, but it also defines covered offense as only the 14 articles under the UCMJ. So long as we're moving forward under any other article, we're absolutely allowed to do so. And I think a hypothetical helps illustrate this point for the court. Murder is a covered offense under the UCMJ. Involuntary manslaughter is not a covered offense. And so if the OSTC were to determine that a reported offense was murder and investigated that offense further and decided, you know what, we don't think we can prove murder, so we're going to defer to the convening authority and allow them to move forward on involuntary manslaughter. Nothing would preclude the government from moving forward on involuntary manslaughter, even though the OSTC had previously determined that the offense might constitute murder. The Congress didn't intend to prevent the government from prosecuting offenses, from non-covered offenses, even after the OSTC has deferred. They wanted the convening authority to be able to move forward on every offense other than those 14 offenses under the UCMJ. Congress was not trying to limit prosecutions. They were trying to give better prosecutions for those 14 specific articles. And so as long as the convening authority is moving forward on an offense that is not one of those 14 articles under the UCMJ, as in we did not charge one of those 14 articles, we are statutorily authorized to do so. Even if it has less elements, even if it seems like it's easier to prove, Congress has allowed us to do so, and there's nothing improper with that.
So is there any limiting principle that prevents the government from recharacterizing, for a choice of terms, any OSTC covered offense to avoid the covered offenses and their jurisdiction or their...
Your Honor, the limiting principle is the fact that the convening authority can't move forward on covered offenses. And that we have to wait for the OSTC to determine whether or not a reported offense is a covered offense and then defer the charges to the convening authority. The OSTC has the ability to look at a reported offense, determine that it is a covered offense and that it might also implicate non-covered offenses, and to take full authority for all offenses which might arise from the conduct. But once the OSTC is determined to defer that conduct back to command, the command has the authority to move forward. It is only statutorily constrained that we don't prefer covered offenses, which is one of those 14 articles. So I don't agree that it's recharacterizing. It's addressing a different crime that is implicated by the same conduct.
So I think that that's a good point, because it's not recharacterized. And I think that, again, I'll use the term constraint. I think that's the constraint or the conflict in the way the government chose to draft the Article 92, because it seems like it's squarely still a sexual harassment. And if we set aside articles and all of that, do you agree that it was Congress's intent to criminalize some sexual harassment? And it's the kind of sexual harassment with which the Office of the Special Trial Counsel deferred, which then ended up in a Specification 1 charge drafted as sexual harassment under an instruction that addresses specifically sexual harassment.
No, Your Honor, I disagree that Congress intended to limit the kind of sexual harassment. Congress wanted the convening authority and the military to address sexual harassment wherever it arises. Sexual harassment was a serious concern for Congress, and they were not seeking to limit the ability of the military to address harassment, whether it rises to a level that is severe or pervasive, or whether the Secretary of the Air Force has determined that harassment that even doesn't rise to the level of severe or pervasive is still detrimental to good order and discipline. And so the convening authority is able to address that type of harassment under Article 92, and he did so in this case. Your Honor, may I briefly conclude?
You may.
The text of the UCMJ is decisive in this case. Based on the plain language, this court should hold that the preemption doctrine does not prevent the government from charging Article 92 and overturn the trial judge's ruling and return the case to trial. If this court decides to address issue 2, it should hold that the plain language of Article 24 Alpha authorizes the convening authority after deferral to refer any charge except for the 14 articles which are listed as covered offenses. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hockenberry, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Senior Judge Gruen, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Scott Hockenberry, along with Major Samantha Castinian. We represent the appellee. This court should deny the 62 appeal for lack of jurisdiction, and also, or perhaps in the alternative, deny it on the merits of the underlying issue. There are not dual sexual harassment offenses set up by Article 134 and the DOTI. There is not a watered-down crime of sexual harassment hiding in the DOTI. The regulation, the DOTI, specifically includes all of the elements of sexual harassment in the definition section or the glossary. And this court should not be convinced, to the extent the government is still arguing this, that the specification does not deal with sexual harassment at all. This framework the government has argued, at least previously, where there's sexual harassment, and then there's something else, which is harassment of a sexual nature, but not sexual harassment. That's not supported by the regulation or by anything else. Regarding jurisdiction, the OSTC declined this exact offense, and this is exactly the framework where referral to a special or general court-martial is prohibited. And the whole point of moving these decisions to highly trained prosecutors was to screen them and stop weak cases going forward, basically ruining service members' lives on the path to an acquittal. Allowing the command to prosecute the exact same conduct just simply under a different number, it completely undermines the purpose, and it would completely destroy the structure of the statute. And to say that just moving it under 92 makes it different, that you could say that for any covered offense. You could have a 120 or a 118 be charged as a 92 dereliction of duty for failing to refrain from sexual assault or from murder. It would just completely nullify the OSTC jurisdiction.
What about, Mr. Huckenberry, the case of Cruz? We'll just use that case fact pattern where it was a domestic violence case, and when the OSTC deferred it, the domestic violence aspect, they went forward and charged, the government did, as a 128 assault, and that, according to our sister court, was legitimate for all of the reasons that Major Basil had just argued, that they're not precluded from taking it as long as it's not a covered offense that's specifically listed.
Right. Your Honor, we would obviously disagree with Cruz, and I would note that that's on appeal to CAF, not granted yet, but I suspect we'll get some CAF case law on that. In this case, there's, I would think in that case, the STC would have to opine that that the lesser offense was not a covered offense. In this case, it's the exact same conduct. I would say in Cruz it was too, to be honest. But they didn't change anything in this case except for the article, and of course they've eliminated some elements.
Mr. Huckenberry, let me ask you this. Do you think that the special trial counsel who took authority over the case, analyzed it, and then deferred it, has the authority to, when deferring back to the convening authority or the commander, to tell the convening authority or the commander that they can go forward on an Article 92 sexual harassment, specifically sexual harassment? Do you think that that would be, per the statute, an authorized course of action? If the OSTC put their stamp on it, do you think that then it would be a legitimate course of action?
Your Honor, I don't. I don't think that OSTC can rewrite the jurisdictional split in the statute. I don't think that they can sort of transfer or delegate their jurisdiction to the convening authority or to the commander convening authority. I don't see anything in the statute that would authorize that. And that also, of course, would not solve the related but separate problem of the fact that this just isn't a crime. What is charged is it doesn't meet the definition of sexual assault in the DOTI. It certainly doesn't meet the definition of sexual assault in Article 134. And the military judge laid it out in pretty good detail, and I think it was paragraph 15 of her ruling. It is missing elements, whether you consider it a 92 or something else. It just isn't, it's missing elements.
So, counsel, is the crux of your argument that there's a preemption issue here under the preemption doctrine proper, or is it a presidential limit, or is it more a failure to state an offense due process problem?
Your Honor, I think there's some overlapping issues with this specification. It is a highly unusual specification. I would say the most fundamental issue is that it simply isn't a crime. The elements, as alleged, are not an offense. They're not an offense under the DOTI or anything else. I think there's also a due process problem with eliminating elements, as the military judge cited case law from CAF and in the Navy Court. I think it was McGinnis and Hoffman. But no, it's not the 134 preemption doctrine proper. I think the government has tried to tried to characterize it that the military judge was extending the Article 134 preemption doctrine, but I think she specifically disclaimed that a number of times, but I would point to page 6 of the ruling. But the same underlying due process principles apply, and it ties in with, it's almost hard to separate, that this just isn't a crime. When you eliminate the victim, when you eliminate the subjective perception, when you eliminate the severe, pervasive, or repetitive requirements, that is not an offense. There is no duty not to engage in something less than sexual harassment. And the way the government has sort of...
Let me ask you this. Do you believe that it would have been appropriate if the government had charged in a way where they wrapped in, tied in all of the elements of the Article 134 sexual harassment, criminal sexual harassment statute or provision? Do you think that then it would be okay to charge this under Article 92? Misconduct.
I think it would be, that would eliminate the problem with that it's not a crime and that it removes elements. It would not really address the jurisdictional issue. In some ways, it would make the jurisdictional issue worse. But it would not have the same due process problems with and notice problems with eliminating elements and charging an offense that just isn't a criminal offense. So I think that would be helpful for issue one, but not issue two, I suppose.
So a point of clarification with respect to your jurisdictional argument. Is it your point that this court doesn't have jurisdiction to hear this appeal, or is it because this was a covered offense that fell under the exclusive authority of OSTC and they didn't exercise that authority?
Yes, Your Honor, I think the latter, that this court always has jurisdiction to determine its own jurisdiction, and if the trial court lacks jurisdiction, then so does this court. And I don't think, to the government's point about the constraints on this court's review in Article 62, I don't think they apply to the predicate question of determining jurisdiction. The government, as Your Honor pointed out, asked this court to make factual findings, attached evidence for this court to make factual findings based on, and that's inconsistent with their position now that this court can't make factual findings about jurisdiction. And Article 62E also says that Article 62 should be construed liberally. So I don't think the constraints on reviewing the underlying ruling of the military judge, I don't think those attach to reviewing the jurisdictional question.
So on that point, I believe the government moved to attach the documents coordinating with OSTC after the filing of your brief in this matter. So now that you've had an opportunity to look at those documents, does that alter your position in any way that there was improper coordination with OSTC?
Well, Your Honor, it does alter our position because I think we had the facts wrong in our brief. So given the structure of the 62, we only got the one brief, I think we basically said there was no OSTIC coordination, and it turned out that was not accurate. There was OSTIC coordination, but that raised its own problem in terms of the deferral and then the commander convening authority going ahead and referring even though it had been deferred. And of course, we would say it's a covered offense. We would say it's a covered offense because the special trial counsel determined it was a covered offense. I think that's clear from the documents the government attached. There's right in Article 24 Alpha, it says how to determine if it's a covered offense. There's a paragraph or a heading called Determination of Covered Offense. C2A, Charlie 2 Alpha. Special trial counsel shall have exclusive authority to determine if a reported offense is a covered offense. And that clearly happened here. So if we want to determine if this is a covered offense, we should look at the paragraph entitled Determination of Covered Offense. And then the remainder of Article 24 Alpha uses that term a number of times, eight times, and it all relates back to C2A, Charlie 2 Alpha, where it's defined. It is, even the SJA sends an email back to the special trial counsel, says, thank you for sending us notice of deferral to the command regarding the covered offense. Everybody knows this is a covered offense. I don't know, I'd be speculating, but that may be why the government charged this strange charging method, was because of the constraints on charging it in a more traditional way. We'd say the jurisdictional problem, and it also caused the issues with the specification, which does not allege a crime. Then there is a notice issue here that wasn't necessarily, there's so many overlapping issues, it's hard to kind of tell where one starts and the other stops, but I think there's a notice issue in terms of how would Sergeant Galvin know that misconduct was prohibited and subject to criminal sanction? Because you have Article 134, which is obviously a source of notice, and it defines sexual harassment with certain elements. You have the DOTI, which has those same elements, both versions of it, because there's a bridging issue here. And now she's criminally charged with an offense that lacks several of those elements. And the government says Congress has created overlapping offenses. Congress didn't create this this DOTI, and the DOTI doesn't create the offense charged. You're kind of trying to say everything they do under Article 92 kind of has the authority of a congressionally created offense, but obviously Congress didn't create this kind of strange specification we're looking at here.
Mr. Hockenberry, if the government had chosen to take the conduct, underlying conduct, and charge it under Article 92 in some way that did not implicate this specific DOTI referring to sexual harassment and did not lay out the fact that her duty was to refrain from engaging in sexual harassment, do you believe that the underlying offense potentially could have been lawfully charged under Article 92? I know it's a bit of a hypothetical, but I'm curious as to your thoughts with respect to a different charging COA for Staff Sergeant Galvin's conduct.
Your Honor, I think that would, similar to your earlier question, would allay a lot of the concerns about issue one. It wouldn't necessarily solve the jurisdictional question. And again, it may make it worse. But if the government had included all the elements and simply charged it under 92 rather than 134, what I would characterize as the main problem here would go away. The main problem being that this is not a crime and it's missing elements. If they had included all of the elements, I think that would have been fine. And it could still refer to the DOTI potentially, but I don't know why they're charging it as a dereliction of duty instead of a violation of a regulation, I guess because of the non-punitive nature. But yes, that would help considerably. They would have to include a named victim, which they didn't hear, the subjective perception of the victim, which they didn't hear, the severity, which they didn't hear. If you look at the model spec for sexual harassment, it has all that in there, and none of that is in the specification here. And it's not just a pleading issue, those elements are not alleged. OSTC deferred this for a reason, because it had no prosecutorial merit, and allowing the government to simultaneously go forward with it anyway, and also lower their burden of proof, It implicates both issues, but that's exactly the opposite of what the new system is designed to do, and it also creates this situation where we have this non-crime, non-sexual harassment charge. Regarding one of the missing elements is the severity, severe or pervasive, or perhaps severe, pervasive, or repetitive. And the government has an argument that under Article 134, it would have to be severe or pervasive, but under the DOTI, the duty is to stop it before it becomes severe or pervasive. And I guess the government's interpretation is therefore it does not have to be severe or pervasive. I would say that the easiest way to dispute that is just the definition in the DOTI specifically said severe or pervasive. But this idea that you have a duty to stop it before it reaches that level, that it is, we were trying to think of a hypothetical that's like saying you have a duty to avoid a car accident. Well, you don't violate that duty unless there is a car accident. So it's kind of a confusing argument, and it's not a lower burden. And we're also looking at sort of some introductory, almost aspirational language in the DOTI here when we have an actual definition, which tracks all the elements of sexual harassment exactly. And in fact, in the most recent version, it just cites back to Article 134 because that is the criminal provision.
So is it your argument that if the duty comes from the DOTI, then if you're going to show a violation of the, if you're going to rely on that DOTI to support a dereliction of duty under Article 92, you must meet all of those elements. In other words, you just have a hypothetical crime or a potential crime. A crime waiting to happen potentially, but no crime at hand. Is that the argument that you're making?
Yes, Your Honor. The definition of sexual harassment in the DOTI is the same as in Article 134. By listing the elements in the prior version and in the subsequent version, which bridges the date range, simply by referencing Article 134 directly. The military judge goes through that in pretty good detail. It's kind of hard to argue with. She says that the December 22 version provides a definition of sexual harassment that requires a subjective belief or perception of the identified victim, the same as Article 134, and the next one in January of 2025 references conduct that constitutes an offense under paragraph 107 of part 4 of the MCM, which is it's just incorporating the elements. So yes, our position would be that a charge under the DOTI, to the extent that was permissible otherwise, would have to have all the same elements.
Counsel, there's some discussion about the Curry case in the briefs. So what's the defense's position on that case? Is that controlling? Are they really using the phrase preempted in the sense of the preemption doctrine, or more with as the government argues, it really just takes precedent?
I think more of the latter, Your Honor. I think it is controlling. I know there was some discussion in some service court cases about whether it was overruled implicitly. But I think everyone, to include the CMA and Curry, the defense here, the judge here, they're not using the word preemption as in the Article 134 preemption doctrine. It's more generic. I might prefer just not to use the word at all because it's confusing. But you know, the higher court used it in Curry in a generic sense, and I think that's how everyone is using it here.
So I think another concept that was wrapped up in the judge's ruling to dismiss, and if we're looking at the legal aspect of the substance of her ruling, what do you make of her position on novel offense? Do you believe that that position that the judge took
stating that this was charged as a novel offense is legally accurate, or do you think that there was something to the government's position with respect to the judge's ruling that this was also a novel offense, charged as a novel offense?
Your Honor, I think the analysis is similar to the preemption issue, that it is not under the Article 134 novel offense doctrine, but some of the same underlying due process concerns apply as kind of discussed by the, I think, the Navy Court in Hoffman. And I'm not sure the Article 134 novel offense doctrine, as it originally was held based on the text. I don't know. I think that text was removed, but there's been some debate, you know, does it still exist because of the underlying due process concerns? And they would apply equally to outside of Article 134. I guess similar to preemption, it's not an Article 134 preemption, it's not an Article 134 novel offense, but these creating offenses that eliminate elements have the same problem even if they're under a 92.
So we'd be within our rights if we were to analyze the substance of the judge's ruling to see that the words preemption and novel offense were used in the justification, maybe not entirely correctly, but because the crux of the ruling was based on an overall due process violation, that would make her ruling non-erroneous?
I think that's right, Your Honor, in terms of if any of the bases in the ruling, or frankly, any alternative bases that this court would find are sufficient to dispense the specification, then it should be dismissed. I don't know that I would say it's erroneous, but everyone is sort of saying preemption, but not Article 134 preemption. It might be simpler just to not use the word at all. In substance, it is the elimination of elements, and I would say it even more simply as just this isn't an offense. It's not an offense under the DOTI. It's not an offense under Article 134.
But are you arguing that preemption works in the way that the judge sort of viewed it outside of Article 134, sort of in the reverse? Do you agree that that's an appropriate way to apply the preemption doctrine?
To the elimination of elements, I would say yes, not just because of the article. I don't think you could charge a punitive article under Article 134, even if you included all the elements. So that would be the Article 134 preemption doctrine would go even further. The issue here is not simply moving it to another article, it's removing the elements.
So does it boil down to it fails to state an offense, in your estimation?
Your Honor, I think that would be an appropriate way to characterize it, is it's just not a crime, which I guess would be another way of saying the same thing. It's missing elements. I guess that's why I say it's overlapping. It's overlapping in terms of the missing elements make it not a crime, and the missing elements also lead to the due process problem of eliminating evidence or eliminating elements and lowering the government's burden of proof and the accompanying notice issues and everything else.
Counsel, what legal effect does a OSTC deferral have in a court?
Your Honor, I think the effect is to constrain the convening authority or the commander convening authority in terms of options. They still have options, but they're constrained, and specifically, they cannot refer to a special or general court-martial.
For covered offense?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is that based on the actual covered offense or the facts underneath the offense?
Well, I guess that is the the determinative question. Our position would be that a covered offense, to determine whether it's a covered offense, the court would look to Charlie 2 Alpha of 24 Alpha, the paragraph determination of a covered offense. And it says that the STC will determine if a reported offense is a covered offense, and that happened here.
Does it make any difference if the STC or the Office of Special Trial Counsel makes a recommendation, defers the case and makes a recommendation as to how it could be charged?
I think that goes to the earlier question. I don't see anything in the statute that allows the STC to sort of cede back their referral power to the commander convening authority. That is sort of just colluding to get around the statute. There's some indication here. I don't think it comes from the STC, but it's in a document the government attached that the OSTC said you charge this as a 92. I think it's in a tracker that a paralegal wrote, but I don't think they have the authority to do that. I don't see anything that gives the lawyer convening authority the power to sort of delegate back to the commander convening authority. Any further questions, Your Honors?
Judge Morgan, anything additional? No. I have no additional questions.
Thank you, Your Honors. The appellee requests that you deny the 62 appeal.
Thank you very much. What? No. Okay, Major Basil, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to highlight the fact that appellee concedes the fact that the preemption doctrine and the novel general disorder offense, the limit imposed by the president under Article 134 doesn't apply in this case. And so that leaves this court only with the determination about whether or not there is some other preemption doctrine that exists that could prevent the government from charging a congressionally enacted statute, and there's not. There's nothing in Article 92 limits the government's ability to charge that offense. And this court would be risking violating the separation of powers in the same way that the trial judge did if it were to find that there was something that would prevent the government from charging Article 92.
Counsel, so on that point, here we have Congress specifically directing the president to enact a 134 offense and directing these specific elements. So is there something different about this 134 than the others in that this is not merely an example of an offense defined by the president, but a congressionally directed offense?
Your Honor, yes, I would agree that this is more like a congressionally directed offense because the Congress directed the elements, but that doesn't change the fact that the government is authorized to pick between two congressionally enacted offenses when we're deciding which charges we're going to move forward with. And so where the government chose to move forward on Article 92 in this case after the special trial counsel deferred, we had the authority to do so. Congress left Article 92 broad even after enacting Article 134, sexual harassment. In that moment, if Congress had wanted to constrain the government from being able to use Article 92 to charge sexual harassment, as we had done prior to the Article 134 offense, and Congress is presumably aware of the laws and aware of the fact that this had been previously charged under Article 92 using these regulations, Congress certainly had the prerogative to prevent us from doing so by including some kind of limiting language. But they didn't. And so the fact that language is absent means that the government is able to choose to go forward under Article 92 as we always have.
I believe there's some language in the DOTI to the effect that an offense punishable under the definition of the DOTI is constitutes an offense triable under Article 134.
Your Honor, that is correct, for sexual harassment. But there is also, within the DOTI, a duty. There's actually three separate duties, as appellee identified and the government agreed, three separate duties under the paragraph that the government charged. And one of those duties imposes the requirement that service members not engage in harassing conduct
even before it rises to the level of severe or pervasive. So while we might move forward under conduct that is severe or pervasive under Article 134, we are authorized and have imposed a duty that members not engage in harassment even before it rises to the level of severe or pervasive. And
so on that,
go ahead.
Well, thank you. On that note, I mean, just looking at the elements of 134, severe, repetitive, or pervasive conduct is what makes an environment hostile or offensive. So what's the basis for separating severe and pervasive from what actually constitutes a hostile environment? How do we determine what constitutes a hostile or offensive environment without severe and pervasive?
Well, Your Honor, that would be a factual determination for the members at the trial court to determine whether or not the government had proved an offensive environment despite the conduct not rising to the level of severe or pervasive. And they might be able to use that definition as a guiding post for making that factual determination about whether the accused is guilty of the offense charge. But where the government has charged every element of Article 92 and we have put the accused on notice of the offense which she must defend against by citing the specific paragraph and identifying the duty that she had violated, we did not fail to state an offense, and there's no reason for this court to dismiss the charge at this level.
So what exactly is the crime here?
Your Honor, the crime is engaging in harassing conduct, which created an offensive environment.
So actually created an offensive environment.
Your Honor, yes.
Of a sexual nature.
Yes, Your Honor, harassing conduct was of a sexual nature. And whether or not that created an offensive environment, despite the fact that it wasn't severe or pervasive or before it rose to the level, Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I?
Please finish.
Thank you. That determination is a factual determination for the fact finder at the trial level to decide whether or not the accused is guilty of the offense, but it doesn't mean that the government has failed to state an offense.
So is this charged as an Article 92.3 or an Article 92.1? Because I believe the motions at the trial level went to lengths to point out that it's a 92.3, but your brief says it's a punitive reg.
Your Honor, I don't have the charge in front of me. I apologize. It's charged as a dereliction of duty. The regulation is punitive. The regulation says that members will be held accountable under the UCMJ for failing to abide by these duties. So we do maintain that the regulation is punitive, but I believe that it's charged as a dereliction of duty. But I'd be happy to provide a supplemental citation to this court.
Yeah, if you would discuss it with respect to U.S. v. Pope, LeBlanc, and Chevernock as to what makes a regulation punitive. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Can I get those case names again?
I believe it's LeBlanc, Chevernock, and Pope.
Thank you, Your Honor. We'll do so.
I do have one question. Okay. So in your brief, you say that the DOD's goal is to prevent harassing behavior. And it's almost like this instruction is a prevention instruction, maybe for leadership to prevent these environments from getting so hostile. Taking that premise, would this have been a more clear situation if the dereliction that Sergeant Galvin was charged with was for failing to prevent harassing behavior that creates an intimidating, hostile, or offensive environment versus what she was charged with, which was refraining herself from harassing conduct that was sexual in nature?
Your Honor, I think that is another way that the government could have charged it, but I maintain that the way that we charged it was still proper because by herself engaging in the harassing behavior, she has fundamentally failed to foster an environment that is free from harassment.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Major Bizon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments. The court will render a decision in this case in due course. There being no further business before the court today, this oral argument is concluded and the court is now closed.
All rise.